True Detective Night Country Episode 3 is over, but here on Post Show Recaps, we're just getting started with a deep dive of Episode 3. My name is Grace, but of course, I'm not alone. I'm here with Jess Sterling. Jess, how you doing?
So excited to be here. So excited to talk about this episode, probably the creepiest episode, which isn't always my cup of tea, but I'm here for it when it comes to True Detective.
Aw, you told me you were going to do your Anders Lund impression the whole time.
I don't think anybody wants that.
Lord of Angelique.
Your mother.
Anders Lund is here. No, that's Sarah Carradine. Sarah Carradine is joining us. Sarah, how are you doing?
Hi, everyone. I'm speaking to you today from the unceded lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. And it's a great pleasure to be here and talk and give you my Andish, which is actually how you say that first name. I know they call him Anders, but it's actually pronounced Andish.
What did you get me with one time when I Baz Luhrmann. It's just bad. You're like, it's just Baz.
Yeah, it's just Baz because you were being very Baz Luhrmann.
Baz. That's what he asked me to call him. Yeah.
So, how dare you?
I don't know what he's telling everybody else. No, Baz Luhrmann. All right, True Detective Night Country, episode 3. It was on our TV. We're halfway through the season.
I know. How are we halfway through? How?
Because it's a short season.
But there's 6 episodes.
I said this with Dr. Amanda. I think that the show continues to be so rich and deep and well-balanced, I think is the thing I keep saying. So if you missed it, Dr. Amanda and I chatted about the recap of the episode right after the episode. Those will drop, and we'll be live for the finale on youtube.com/postshowrecaps. Make sure you subscribe to get all of our post-show recaps True Detective coverage, postshowrecaps.com/TrueDetective, or just search for True Detective in your podcast or feed of choice. Very delighted that my coworker today was like, so I was just searching for True Detective podcast because I love the show, and then I found you podcasting about it, so what the heck. Laura, if you're listening, hello. In addition to us here on the deep dive, then Mike Bloom and LaTanya Starks are doing the Versus pod where they're comparing season 1 of True Detective with season 4 of True Detective. So make sure you're subscribed. I'm going to actually start with you, Sarah. You're the guest here. And I want to know, as we are halfway through the show, what you've made of True Detective Night Country so far.
Well, look, to be very broad, I love it. Love every minute about it. To be less broad, I can go into some details. It's interesting that the Versus is between season 1 and season 4. Feels to me very much, I mean, obviously we're not going to spoil anything about season 1 here, but they feel much more a matched pair or a mirror pair than 2 and 3 to me, anyway. So
I make a joke about how season 4 is women-centric and you're calling it broad, and so we'll just move on. Yada, yada, yada.
We're just three broads, broadly speaking.
Good podcast name. I don't know if that's a
broadly speaking.
TM.
Copyright it. Me.
It's probably a podcast, but yeah.
So for me, speaking about broads, I mean, it has to be said that Jodie Foster and Fiona Shaw and I are all pretty much the same age. So it's really nice, such a stupid word. It's incredible to see, like, particularly Jodie Foster being unpleasant. Having an unpleasant lead is just like, oh, thank you so much. And that it's almost all broads and actors that I'm being introduced to for the first time. The Indigenous actors in particular that I don't know who are just a revelation. The starkness of the white invaders, the white colonizers in a land they don't understand, which is sort of what I think thematically it is. I mean, listening to all the theories that you have, I think it's broadly speaking either something woo-woo spiritual, otherworldly is happening, or we're fucking the earth. Well, it's actually we are fucking the earth, but in terms of what's actually happening to everybody. But there's also, to me, this idea of, you know, colonization and belonging and not belonging. And then we get to this episode where even within culture there's belonging and not belonging, when Navarro always asks for her name and she doesn't know it, which just was like such a gut punch to me that she does not know her name. And that, so we get both the birth scene where she is at first told to fuck off and then invited in and takes her hat off and finds her way in. Also, we have that with Leah, the stepdaughter of an Indigenous woman as a stepdaughter of a white woman who is either actively trying to keep her culture away from her, but then we really saw it again. There's a real turns in this episode. It felt like her culture was being kept from her by her white stepmother, and then we see that white woman is trying to keep her safe because she knows what happens to Indigenous women and girls. So there's the layers are just so intricate and real. And there's also a feeling like if you can't quite figure out what's going on, don't worry, just watch it. There's also that aspect to it where you can just watch it because it's so beautiful and terrifying and elevated and extraordinary. And my other theory about what's going on is it's just a very strange place. It's like, you know, it's a place of oddness and we don't belong there. We don't belong there. And so, of course, strange things are going to happen to us. Of course, we're going to hear our name being called on the wind. Of course, we're going to see things that aren't there, feel a little hand. That moment when episode 1, where Jodie Foster's in bed and the little brown hand just touches her shoulder. And she doesn't do that thing that we, you know, that bad actors do. She just wakes up from that dream and the hand just slips off her shoulder, which was very tender and touching, but also we see the little hand again. So there's some meaning there. Jess, before I fall off a cliff myself and freeze in a pond, episode 3.
I love it. I mean, obviously, like you were saying, this episode is very haunting. I feel like we're really leaning into like the spiritual stuff in this episode in a way that I think so works for the show, specifically because I think the pacing through 3 episodes has been so on point. We are now at the halfway mark. And while we don't exactly have clear answers to kind of anything at this point, we have leads and I don't feel frustrated by the lack of answers. I feel like we're leaning in the right direction. Like we're getting little bits of information, right? We get like that information this week about like Hank knew some stuff and he did not say the stuff. And that's bad. You know, we're getting little bits of information all the while really fleshing out these characters, which for me is always number one in a show, like let alone the vibes and the scenery and all of that stuff. It's how three-dimensional do these characters feel? How lived in do they feel? How connected do I feel to them? And after this episode, oh my gosh, like I just feel so, so connected to almost all of these characters, specifically Navarro. I love what we're getting from her and her background and her history. I loved the conversation that we get with her and Kavik. Like I just thought there was so much to glean from that conversation and her history and just how much of an outsider she is in her own community. You know, it's so fascinating. I'm so excited to dive into all of it. I went down a little bit of a Reddit rabbit hole, as I'm known to do. If you listen to any of the Yellow Jackets deep dives, I love a tinfoil hat theory. And the best thing about this show is it's 6 episodes and like we should have the answers to the questions that we're asking, maybe not everything, you know, they might do a little bit of the let the mystery be, but we're going to get those answers in 6 episodes. So I love it. I'm so excited to chat about this episode.
Yeah, I think that is, it's, you know, we love these mystery box shows and they are so tricky to pull off effectively because you want to feel like every week you're getting more information. They can start asking new questions, but you want to feel like you're moving. You have forward momentum towards resolution in the, at least to the central thing of the show. In this one, I think that's probably what happens to the Arctic research, the researchers. Secondary, I think also, like, I think that that's intertwined with what happened with Annie, obviously, because the tongue is at the research station. So how do you give more and more without giving all of it away? There was really interesting when we covered the after party, Jess and Miller and Lord talked about like, actually, I feel like in a 10 episode season, most people maybe should actually be able to guess that by episode 7, like, oh, it's right, probably that person. Like that feels like the trajectory in terms of where you kind of want to people to be able to have guessed it. Maybe not everybody, but also if it's like out of nowhere in the last episode, not really great. So we're almost there. I feel like by next episode, that's, you know, if my math is right, 4 or 5. And it's a condensed season, so it's a different pacing. But yeah, I just do think the things we got, I think to your point, it's not just these like, ooh, we found this clue and piece of information. Like the stuff and the way I'm so excited for where this is going is the way in which the two things, which is like the mystery of what happened and then these people and the and getting to know these people, how are those two things eventually going to intertwine right. and tell a fascinating story? So where I want to start is the fact that I feel like one of the biggest things that happens this episode is Navarro's identity, specifically in not having an Inupiaq name. And I was listening to, on Dr. Mano's recommendation, the official HBO podcast, and I listened to the episode 2 podcast. I haven't listened to the episode 3, but they were talking about the name Navarro in that she is Dominican. And this is kind of what you're saying, Sarah, this idea that within culture, there is belonging and not belonging. And so Navarro feeling isolated from the community that she is trying to protect, that she feels like she so desperately, she is a part of it, and also feels like she's in some ways outside of it. That's the opening scene where she comes and she's not, you know, she's not involved in what's happening until she is involved in it. She does not have the Inupiaq name. And so when Oliver, you know, asks her, she doesn't have an answer, but she's stubborn and defiant. But Jess, my, you know, your rabbit hole discovery leads us to believe that is Navarro not having an Inupiaq name potentially a thread to pull on?
Yeah, it's so fascinating. So I did see this post by Deb Wisco Gal, and she kind of had some, I'm going to assume it's a she, but I should say they. They had some interesting theories about this and how having this spiritual name, having this Inupiaq name, is so important. Like you receive it during a naming ceremony. It signifies the beginning of an earthwalk connected to the spiritual world. So that name is kind of, they call it a spiritual driver's license. It's a form of protection and identification. And to your and Sarah's point, when you introduce yourself to someone, they want to know what your Inupiaq name is. And so her not having that removes her a bit from that culture in a way that, you know, we're seeing it through Leah as well. You know, she's removed from her culture. And I think it also is a little bit of a tricky situation for Navarro that she's a police officer. And, you know, I don't know that that causes conflict as well between her and her people. And so it's so fascinating that to me, like this is the biggest thread to possibly pull on, is Navarro's name, her not having this Inupiaq name that she should have, and how she's like very much removed from the culture of the people that she's trying to protect, right? Like yeah. Sarah, she's doing her best to get an answer to the mystery of who killed Annie Kay. What happened?
Can I also just say, Sarah, the other piece I want is that she is the one who is maybe most hearing. She's a Lund. I'm just going to say
They all say Anders, so we can say Anders, but you can
He speaks Anders. To her, right? Yeah. He speaks to her. So she is the one who is having this because she goes to Rose and Rose is talking about when she sort of this unlocked for her. And so interestingly, she feels disconnected, but in ways the show is telling us, well, maybe she's actually in some ways, not more connected than anybody, but more connected than maybe Danvers or other people who are involved, right?
Well, it's interesting that relationship with Rose because it's as if they both are straddling several worlds. Rose comfortably and Navarro has some discomfort. I mean, the physicality of this actor is incredible. And the size and look difference between her and her sister, I think, is really fascinating. Her sort of large protectiveness of this tender, broken sister, I think, is fascinating. And yet she can't give her what she was never given. I mean, this is the journey for people who are taken from their culture is like, how do you then get it back? You know, as an adult, do you learn a language? As an adult, do you learn the stories? Whereas a child like Darwin that's just getting it, you know, getting it with the mac and cheese is very different. So there's like a lived, this is actually what I mean, I know we're talking about Navarro, but if I can take a little swerve.
Yeah.
From the first moment of the first episode, all these people had lived there forever, knew each other, had backstories, like you could feel it just resonating off the screen. And the the creators didn't need to feed us information. I mean, was Leah Danvers' stepdaughter? And this episode, episode three, was the first time that, I mean, of course, we gleaned it and we were right, but she says, oh, no, she's my stepmother. So the creators never felt like they had to give us all the answers. They felt very confident that we would sit with the information, and I happily did because I could tell these people knew each other. This episode, we get that incident where Danvers and Navarro go to a murder-suicide. They find him dead, she says. Whereas when we see the vision of it, he's very much alive.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that. We'll talk about Will Wheeler. Yeah.
Yes. But my broader point is that I believed all these people and their relationships from the first moment. And that led me to not mind if there were questions that weren't answered, because it's like the questions and their answer isn't the whole point. It's the hook, but it's not the whole point. But yes, Navarro and her connection to culture, we've seen her slight physical unease, her holding back, her watchfulness. And it's really, this episode was like so revelatory of where that's come from and what happens when you take people's culture away.
Mm-hmm. So the other piece with Navarro, Jess, and I it really stood out to me is this final scene where Lund wakes up and he sits up in his bed. But the way it's shot is Danvers is trying to get information out of him. Who are you talking about? Yes, you woke her up, but who? And Amanda and I theorized whether or not there was a name there. I've rewatched it with the closed captioning. I don't think he ever names a name. She leaves because the hillbillies are fighting in the waiting room. Classic. That's what happens.
Classic problem.
Yeah. Classic. And the camera. Yeah. 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 The camera cuts and blocks him out of frame. Mm-hmm. And what I find interesting about this specific thing that happens is that the horror movie thing is to like see the monster come up, you know, that's what it is. And like, we know that's happening and we get to see it. And it's not like they block him out the whole time. It's not like she's not looking. Amanda's theory is that this is now a Navarro hallucination.
That's what I love most about this, is because of Navarro's genetic history, right? Like her mother suffering from something, her sister suffering from something. Obviously, any viewer is going to wonder, is Navarro having visions or is this real? And why is it Navarro that this is happening to versus a Danvers who does, you know, we get the moment with her son in the hand and all of that, right? And that's mostly, in my opinion, because Ennis is a weird place. Weird stuff happens in the dark, you know?
100%, Jess, absolutely. So, yeah. It's a liminal space, as we would say.
Exactly. And
it's where the seams of the fabric of society are coming apart.
Yes. And so
absolutely.
Yeah. The having it be Navarro and having Lund talk to Navarro, of course you get the question of an unreliable narrator of, did this actually happen? And I read another thing on Reddit, also by Deb Wisco Gal, about pointing in this show, which I thought was so fascinating, where we get, the first thing we get is Travis, you know, Travis pointing points to the frozen scientist, to Rose. And we can look at Rose as someone who has this kind of relationship with the dead, with the deceased, with the spiritual world, right? And I think we would look at Navarro the same way. And so what Deb Wisco Gal had said was, both the pointing of Travis and Lund pointing towards Navarro imply a border crossing between the spirit world and this world. And I thought that was so fascinating. Like, he's crossing from one world to the next. And I feel like Navarro is the hinge point in that, you know? She is the one who, why would the spirit world talk to Danvers? You know what I mean? Like, why?
Yeah. Well, she wouldn't listen for a start. But I mean, this is interesting to me with, if it's a hallucination or mental imagination or creation, you know, here she's very connected to Rust with hallucinations, although his came from, chemical damage, and hers is from ? So I like those little flashes of the references backwards and forwards. But yeah, because we lose sight of Lund and then he sits up into frame, and it's behind her. Not only are we being treated to the classic horror framing, but we also, and her face is so calm, we also kind of are inside her as well in a very strange way. I think there's a very visceral camera eye on these actors that lets us almost be inside them. And it's that idea of the hairs on the back of the head. And unlike a horror film, she doesn't turn and scream. She just hears him and what he says.
She's awake, and your mother.
I won't say the rest of that line from The Exorcist, but yes.
No.
If it is him, and if it is him, no. If this is an innocent rating, and if it is him in his final throes, because he's about to cross through the veil himself, there's not a lot of him left. I mean, he's only got one hand left, so the pointing has to come from that hand. It's not out of the question that people, I mean, I don't know if you've sat with people as they've died, they can say some very strange things.
It's true.
And it's just the brain is trying to sort things out. So if there was this idea of we've woken her up from before, it's not out of the question that that he still has that thought in his mind. Is he talking about Namara's mother, or if you're going to be, no woo-woo, we're going to be in the real world, it might be something that he would say, your mother is waiting for you. His mother, or our mother, or, you know.
And it could be because he also said the she's awake, right? Like the running thread of she's awake throughout the show as well. I know, Grace,
he says that to Danvers, but then, so that's in like his like spewing, he's, you know, that's like from, you know.
And we saw that at the scientists, like the Salal. That has been something that is like very clear that everyone has seen that, you know, or heard it. But the thing is, I said, the first podcast we did, I said, maybe it's Mother Nature. Maybe Mother Nature is the she and she's awake, right? I thought it was very specific. They used a feminine pronoun, you know, she, her. However, the longer this goes on, I also wonder if like, is he speaking about Navarro? And like in the awake, I'm thinking the word awake being like an enlightened sort of awake.
Oh my God, Navarro is so woke. She's so woke.
Exactly. Oh, she's so woke right now. Is this dormant part of her, this culture that she's been around, but kind of always on the outside looking in? Is there something to do with that? You know, it just pings in my brain because we have Navarro, who maybe can be looked at as an unreliable narrator in some ways. But also you can't forget that she is a part of that culture, but also not a part of that culture in many ways. So there's something there. My brain is always spinning after I watch these episodes because there's so many threads to pull on.
She, your brain? Is she awake?
My brain is always awake.
Yeah. I mean, the people who've said it, right, are Raymond Clark, Navarro has heard it, Anders Lund has said it, and I believe Danvers hears it when she's, and then she wakes up.
Did you say Navarro with the polar bear, right? Because that was when she heard it.
Yeah, Navarro.
Okay, sorry, you said that. Like, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, just Navarro being a person who is. So
yeah, the one-eyed polar bear. Yeah.
These are the people, and so I guess what I'm trying to is like, is there Raymond Clark is the for me the biggest like, where like, I guess Navarro Lund says it in front of Danvers, but with Navarro and that clicks to her that like, oh my God, yeah, I've been hearing that. So I'm just trying to make a connection between like, is there a way where you because. Here's the piece. I know like in episode one, there was some feedback about like, oh, I know that they're playing in the supernatural, but I want the answer to be not supernatural. I want it realistic. To be, I want the show, show is a crime. And so the more that we go, it's fine that there are these supernatural elements, but and so, you know, I think about this last scene where Navarro, I think has basically a hallucination is how I will interpret it for now. The piece is like, that doesn't mean that I need to forever think that like Navarro doesn't can move away being like, that's true. That happened to me, whether or not, however it happened, it's a true experience for her that it happened. Right. But do we need an explanation for why Navarro might be having hallucinations or spiritual awakening. This idea, I go back to Rose saying there are three reasons people come to see you. It's to come, they miss you. They want to take you with them, or they want to tell you something that you need to hear. And so I think about that when Anders is passing over to the other side, he's delivering a message basically on behalf of her mother, who's saying, this is a message you need to hear. Is her mother, she's waiting for you. So she's trying to take her with her. Does there need to be an explanation, Sarah, for why Navarro at the end of episode 6, does there have to have been like, well, it's very clear that this happened. Navarro was having hallucinations because of this thing. Or could she be somebody who that as a white, as I'm saying this as like a settler, like, do I not understand that world? And if they choose to go a route that says she is spiritual in some way, like Rose says she is.
Well, that's what it is. I, you know, famously anti-woo, but I love the creepiness. I love the supernatural elements. I do want the answer to the set mysteries to be rooted in this world, shall we say. But, you know, any of us who have heard our name being spoken in an empty room, as I have, you know, there are these moments. I have mental health issues, but not hallucinatory ones. But there are things that happen. There are moments where you go into a room and you go, something here. Now, to me, some people would say, oh, that's because you felt the energy. But to me, it's because you don't realize it, but a cup was upside down, or, you know, there was something there that should have been there, or the other way around. So we, you know, that's our vibrational field, is actually us and our observations, but we don't bring them to the forefront of our minds. And the way that Navarro is receiving the polar bear, the voice, the crucifix she had to throw out the window very calmly, I like it so much. It's as if, and when she bangs her head and goes somewhere and comes back, it's just the ow, the physical back of the head, rather than, oh my God, where did I go? What did I see? And it feels very contained. So I'm liking that. But yes, at the end of 6 episodes, if we don't know why, we don't know why. That to me is fine.
So Jess, I want to ask, so the person that Navarro, I think, sees in when she's running in the, she's away from the hut.
Is that the person that scuttled across the station?
I believe it's Holden. I think she thinks she sees. I think there's I've looked at it a couple times, and it seems like the kid is holding. So interestingly, here's what's interesting, Jess. I think that she interestingly thinks she hallucinates, like, or whatever, sees a person who then, when she falls and hit her head, and now we're in like unreliable narrator territory. And the Yellow King is a story of someone falling off a horse, and now one of the stories is about a woman who's, and the whole time she's an unreliable narrator. So the fact that this is now Navarro, but then in the dream, I feel like she also sees Holden. That's my interpret, is that she sees, so I could be wrong about who she's seeing in the ice, but I think certainly there's no doubt that it's Holden when she's in the desert, maybe a flashback direct.
Certainly. Yeah.
So, but the other piece, I was a bit confused about, why would she see Holden? Why is she? And then Dr. Amanda says, so I'm, you know, are we to believe that potentially Danvers and Navarro have more of a close relationship than we were led to believe? And it blew my mind because I wasn't looking at it. And then I'm like, oh my God, it's a Jodie Foster role. Like, okay.
You could interpret a lot of the things that are said between them in many different ways. And certainly her saying like warning. Why am I blanking on his name? Is it Peter? The younger.
Oh, yep. Peter Pryor.
Peter. Yeah. Peter Pryor. I think it is Peter.
Peter Pryor.
Picked a pack of pickled peppers.
Peter from before is really good. Sarah.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. But, you know, she's a name like
the character names are very carefully selected.
I agree.
Very carefully selected. Yeah. Sorry, Jess.
No, you're good. But so her saying like, oh, watch out for Mrs. Robinson, right? Like, is that from her own?
I love that he didn't know. That was brilliant.
He didn't. Now it made me feel old because he's supposed to be around 30. I know Mrs. Robinson.
Yeah, but he's from Alaska. He's from Alaska.
Whatever. That's what they want to do.
When his father said Mrs. Robinson, I thought, I just flashed. I thought, he doesn't know who that is. And he didn't. And then I was delighted for being right. And I looked around my empty room to go, I said paradoxical undressing in the first episode two, and again looked around to have a backpack. But
it's interesting to speculate on a romantic interaction between them because of the, like, you on Tinder, you still screwing everything that can't run fast enough to get away from you, right? Like, and we also get confirmation, or not confirmation, I should say, but like Danvers says, like, are you still having sex with Kavik, or did you go back to women? Yeah. And that's the first time we've heard anything about Navarro's sexuality beyond seeing her with Kavik.
Yeah.
Mm. I think it's interesting too, in this, what delighted me in this episode is we saw Navarro's pettiness, because she's been so high-minded and so right and so righteous. And now she's being petty, because we've saw the Danvers Peter Pryor relationship of mentor mentee, ask the right questions. Are you asking the right questions? And now Navarro comes in. And it's like, that's the previous mentee. That's the previous person who she's trained with the questions.
Evangeline Pryor.
Yeah.
And she's Evangeline Pryor. Yeah. And she now is very petty towards Peter, calling him freshman. And it's like, I went through that training and now I see her for who she is, but you don't see her for who she is. And so there's this fantastic triangle between the three of them, which was giving me a lot of amusement. It lightened the mood somewhat, and it was so real, and again spoke about their prior relationship and what it had been to what it is now. Yeah. And we see that also in the way that they just slide straight back into working together really, really well. Even their movements as they stood in the circle of photos and turned their heads was slightly choreographed in the most wonderful way, indicating they have done this, they have worked together before. If they've had sex together before as well, that makes even more sense. Perhaps that's just my headcanon. But it's, this is what I'm talking about this lived history that's in people. And we see a different aspect of it here.
Mm-hmm. I as soon as Amanda said it, I was like, it's the reason why it's annoying is because I didn't see it. I didn't catch it before, but I think it's a really good point. In episode two podcast, Issa Lopez talks about what are the things that are keeping the two of them apart and what are the things that are pulling them together. And as soon as I listened to it after I talked to Amanda, and I was like, oh man, Amanda's so right. I think that they must have had some sort of intimate relationship that is clearly the basis for why it is so heated. And the other piece too, though, Jess, I think probably has to do with Will Wheeler and the story she tells to Peter, and that it was a murder-suicide, but in fact we see that it's not. And also Twist and Shout is playing, which is the song that she turns
He's
off.
Whistling it. He's creepily whistling Twist and Shout, which I didn't know Twist and Shout would be creepy. But you took the words out of my mouth. I was going to say, if there's not a romantic entanglement history between them, certainly keeping this Will Wheeler secret a secret, I mean, has to cause tension, right? We still don't know. We don't know who killed him. We know one of the two of them probably did, but we don't know which one. And I think it could be either one of them, really.
Well, what's your bet? Because Amanda and I did this where we went back and forth about, like, it does feel like it will be Navarro, but then you could read it that, like, they're going to pull it. They don't show it in this episode, so you could see that it's actually Danvers who does it. So I'm just interested in between the two of you, who you think actually killed Will.
I think Navarro, we've had enough. Yeah. I mean, I talked about her calmness, but we've had enough of her, you know, sparking off fireworks, righteous anger, the way she's held on to Annie. Whereas Danvers is just constantly unpleasant. So she doesn't have like a buildup of pressure that's released. She just releases all along the way. You know, she crop dusts.
I think it's totally fair, Jess. I think that's a totally fit that, like, it's just Navarro, and then Danvers is like, well, I'll cover up for you, but you're absolutely not allowed to. You're out. You got to go to the state troopers.
Specifically, I think we see a lot of the temper, I guess I would say, but righteous temper. I'm not saying, you know, she's wrong for being angry, but towards like Hank this episode, right? When she finds out he's been withholding information for all of this time, and Danvers is the one who steps in and she's like, get back to work. And Navarro's like, are you kidding me? Just get back to work. Like, it certainly feels like the show wants us to feel like it was Navarro who killed Wheeler. I do think it's possible it was Danvers, and that she did it so that Navarro didn't have to, if that makes sense. Like, maybe she sees Navarro about to do it and Danvers like, no, I'll take it. You know, I'll do this. So I could easily see it being that. I guess, you know, for fun's sake, I'll say Danvers because I think it would be interesting if it was her. But certainly like keeping that secret. And now we know, I mean, at least in my opinion, now we know why she hates the Beatles, because this man, the creepiest whistle of Twist and Shout that ever did exist, and I wouldn't have even known it was this song if not for the closed captioning, because it doesn't it's not like he's like, shake it up baby now, you know, he's like, it's like the most eerie creepy thing ever.
I kill my wife. Yeah. Kill my wife.
It's like, I thought it was weird when he was like, oh hello, oh yes, yes, I'm here, yes. Yes.
Pass the marijuana lingo.
We're the Beatles, yes. That was weird.
We're bigger than
that's
Jesus.
That's a deleted scene, I think. Yeah. Yeah, so I think certainly that's a, you know, an indication of where their relationship has really fallen out. And I think, you know, Amanda pointed out that, you know, that where do you put the cans? It's such a level of interest to me that that honestly could just be from like, it's a small community when you work with people.
No, but that is so specific. Like there's, yeah. You don't just go, like you have to have been in someone's house a lot to be like, I know where the cans are. Like yes, to me, that
top,
is like.
Top right shelf, right? I don't know.
No, you're wrong, Grace. but on top of that, I also think, you know, because we talked about Navarro seeing Holden's hand, we think it's, you know, Holden because the hand and the polar bear with one eye, all of that. Also the fact that Navarro is like having a vision of Danvers' child feels important. Like
that's the point I was bringing
like
up
some
about
connection.
Yeah. The fact that she's potentially seeing Holden. And just to go back to this, do both of you think that you actually thought maybe it's Raymond Clark she sees in the snow. Sarah, is that what you were asking? That's the same.
Sorry, I apologize.
Not that you think it's Raymond Clark, that you thought it's the same person who's in the Tussauds station at the beginning. That I believe is Raymond Clark. So I've put two and two together, but you wonder whether that's the same person in the snow.
What did you get to when you put two and two together?
So you saying, oh, it's the same person in the station. Then was like, oh, Raymond, but you might not have been saying that was Raymond, but I was saying it was Raymond because I believe it's Raymond in the station in episode
in
one.
The station.
So is that clear? Clear as mud?
No. It is. I was just checking your mental arithmetic.
Yeah, I know. I think I got it, but
I think I got it. I think you got it too. I think it's the same, whoever it is, it's the entity that we all see out of the corner of our eye as we walk down a dark street, skittering through. So again, I don't mind if that's never explained or if that's never a particular person, because like hearing our voice spoken in an empty room, it's something that everybody has experienced and, you know, is used in great effect in horror films. But I like your idea, Grace, that they are perhaps different entities. Does that mean they're both dead or one's dead and one's alive?
Well, what's interesting though is like when she falls, so she sees someone, and when she's like going to chase after them, she then hits her head. And then
they throw the ball back, right?
An orange.
Whoever it is throws the ball. Yeah. Orange, sorry. Which is in the opening credits, I noticed when I rewatched.
Yes, it is in the opening credits. Yeah, along with the bathtub of blood, Jess, I think is the only thing we have not yet like seen or been alluded to.
I can wait on that. You know, I don't need to see a bathtub of blood.
I imagine it's in the hatch we discover at the end of the episode. But from my reading, when I look at the person who's running, to me it seems like Holden. But again, I want to just like the choice
is
that
creature. Could it be an animal?
I think very clearly it's a human holding a polar bear teddy bear. So here's the piece that I'm getting to. Similar to like we see Anders Lund in the bed and then it cuts him out of frame and then we move back into it. If this is right, that I think it's Holden who's running, she runs to him, then she falls. Now she's hit her head and now she's having an hallucination about Holden. But I think that it potentially is the same, right? Do you get what I'm saying? That I feel like
that it's not. And I think the bigger or not a big thing, but something to point out in that same scene is she throws the orange.
Yeah.
And then it ends up right back next to her. So someone touched the orange. Like I do think. I don't think her hitting her head had anything to do with why she sees Holden. I think she's going to see Holden no matter what.
I actually think hitting her head is what is going to make other people say, well, you hit your head on the ice. And she's going to say,
But is she telling anybody about this though? Is she telling anybody? Because she hasn't told anybody
about it. She says she has a headache or something. And then like, well, what happened? She lets it, you know, she lets it slip. She lets her demeanor down, especially with Danvers, if they have a relationship. I think the piece. So yeah, I just think because I see that the sequence of that, right. I think she's kind of seeing and hearing all these the same stuff, and for her it's very consistent. But now what we're gonna, I think where it will lead potentially is that people will now question her in the way that Rose says to about her sister, don't confuse spirituality for mental health concerns. Mm-hmm. Let's just what we have to, I think, to for the last little bit of this pod, which is, I think there's so much stuff here about like Raymond Clark and Navarro and who Danvers is and all of this stuff. But the central mystery, again, of the show is like what happened to the people on the ice. And so we do.
Yes.
There's a few things that I just want to try to talk through and surmise. So last episode, we get the piece about like, you know, why did they leave? And they're asking all these questions. And this episode, the veterinarian, the cousin of Phil, another prior, maybe, who knows, comes in and says that these people didn't. This is not what it looks like when you die from hypothermia. It's a very actually calming death. So we get that information. We also know from last episode, there's a symbol on somebody's head. So all of these things, I do feel like this is where the show, I think very smartly, having another thing to like put in the like murder mystery, you know, we're trying to figure out this thing, was actually really smart, because they're only really giving us like maybe one piece of information about these people, like the missing men, which again was like kind of advertised. Yeah, was advertised as kind of the main mystery of the show. But because there's this other thing, they can give us a bunch more information each week. And that like sustains our for like, yes, we must know what's going on. While I think still leaving a lot of this stuff. And I still feel like I'm pretty in the dark, Jess, about and as they are in Night Country, but about what might have happened to these people. Because I don't think we've gotten like, we get a little bit. We get like these like morsels each week.
Right. We get a connection to the caribou in the very first scene of the whole show or season, I should say, where it's, you know, they get scared off, and that, you know, it is not a peaceful death is freezing to death. These men do not look like that is what happened. You know, of course we have like did you think he scratched his own eyes out? And, you know, the weird folded up clothes nearby and the symbol on someone's head. It's all very, it points to tampering, points to someone else is involved in this, which is why it's so important to find Raymond Clark, right? Maybe he possibly has some answers. But I truly think we're getting so much of, and this could just be them involving the culture and involving like setting the scene, the world building, all of that. But we're getting so much about how dangerous these mines are, how the water is black. Babies are being born, stillborn, because of how black this water is. Danvers witnesses it, right? She goes to like this kind of ceremony they have for the baby and, you know, pay respects, I guess. And she goes into the bathroom and the water is black, right? When Leah goes to the big meeting, if you will.
The protest meeting. Yeah.
Protest. They're handing out water bottles that are filled with black water. Yeah. There's so much. And I talked about this at nauseam on the Yellow Jackets podcast, but the effects of like mercury poisoning and how they lead to hallucinations. And if you want the answers to all of these mysteries to be rooted in realism, I feel like you got to look at like the poisoning aspect, right? The fact that the land they literally live on, Sarah, is like poisoning their people, and how that could impact, or could it have been one of the people that's been impacted, right? Some of the Inupiaq people, or someone who has have black water or whatever, maybe they're poisoning the scientists, you know? I just feel like we can't forget that that is still a thing that is happening in Ennis.
And I love all of that, and the coring that the scientists were doing. You know, we see all the ice cores and that idea of, and we have that in our world now of like, well, if you melt the ice in the Arctic, if you drive a core down, what are you going to find? The X-Files loved stuff like that, that you wake up, she wakes up, she might be a microbe, she might be a virus, or she might just be Earth's balance that you are unbalancing. And the other thing about this, sorry, I'm going off on a slight tangent now of this.
It's kind of the point of the podcast.
Is the idea of the scientists have been out there at Sala, they've been doing all this work, and none of it has any meaning because of the difficulty of stabilizing these core samples that they have, or whatever it is. We do have another scientist just completely dismissing the work that's there. And again, that's a dichotomy we often see in films. Oh, those scientists are mad. They don't know what they're talking about, when in fact they know exactly what's going on.
Or I haven't heard of that, of a mad scientist.
A mad scientist that is in fact the one that has the truth.
Yes.
So have they disturbed something? The mine is obviously terrible, and yet it's the economy, stupid, right? So 50% of the town works at the mine. What do you do if the mine goes? You know, we have mines here in Australia that are doing untold damage and blowing up sacred sites, and I've been the most terrible, awful thing, but it's like, but it's so much money. It's so much money. So perhaps capitalism is the thing that's killing them all. But yes, seeing, we've heard about the water and we finally see it both in the bottles and in the tap. And the fact that Danvers actually has her hand under the tap as the water hits it. And then it's almost like she doesn't know what to do with her hands, because how do you wash the filth off your hands if there's no water, clean water to wash it with? Yeah.
I think the piece for me that I, you know, when we early on, and we'll do this again today as well, like kind of forgot last week, but I think we both would have just kept our answers, our detective answers,
correct,
the same.
Yes.
But I think the piece for me is, like, I think if you know that the water's bad, you don't drink it. So especially if you're the scientist, I have the most. So then I think, like, okay, that's where my guess of, and Sarah, so we try to lock it. So basically, in episode one, we locked in a theory. If we ever want to change it, it's worth less points.
Now we're
changing it. That's
yes,
the idea.
I love
we'll
it.
See who, and
we'll I see love who gamifying. let's see who wins. Yes.
Gamifying.
Oh, Grace
murder.
On a podcast gamifying something? What? Never heard of it.
Pretty weird. So my theory,
and I
is
think
that
you were very bold to say, "Well, I won't have the same theory as you." So that was very. Well, very
it's for fun, right?
You gotta. But I actually do think more and more that my theory, that which is that I don't know that you would just say, like, well, they're all being poisoned because they're drinking the water. Well, if the water's black, I don't think, and maybe that's a total misrepresentation of my knowledge of what happens to communities who don't have clean drinking water, because my assumption is that you still don't drink, or you try to figure out a way. And I guess I'll look into that because I feel like that's it's a huge problem, especially it might be an economic thing.
So
yeah.
So drink bottled water. So if you're the scientists at Sala,
100%, this is what I'm saying. Yeah.
They're getting pallets of water delivered.
Yes.
But if you are a working stiff on minimum wage,
you might try to boil the water
because you can't afford to be drinking bottled water.
Yeah.
And also the water's touching your food, the water's touching your face, the water's falling down it's not raining, falling down in the snow, the water's in the ice. It's not just the water that's coming out of the tap. So I mean, there might be a thing where you pour the water in the glass and you put it aside to settle, and then you try and drink the clear stuff off the top. I mean, it's just horrifying.
So the piece here, I think, is like, if we take what happened to Raymond, which is he's the one who says she's awake, and now we look at Navarro, who is the one who's also hearing this, what connections could we make between why these two people, and then generally, like, what happened to people? But I would more so put my stock into you, what specifically happened to Raymond Clark rather than the rest of the men, because we see that the man who is making his sandwich, actually, we see all of them, and they seem perfectly fine.
They're just hanging out.
So what are the things that might be happening to Raymond that might also be happening to Navarro that might lead both of them to do something a la chase all the men out, put them out in the snow, make them take off their clothes, draw symbols on their forehead, leave them there, and they die? And why? Who does he think he's awake? And Lund is saying that because Raymond was saying that, so et cetera, et cetera. So perhaps it is a good time to revisit our guesses. Jess, your guess is that I believe I'm going to check my episode one notes, but basically just that the water is contained, the water, like, something is contaminating,
right,
and poisoning them. My episode one guess is basically that somebody was actively poisoning them. I think I might want to change it because I think more and more I don't think it's all the men who are being poisoned, because the other piece here is that it says we are all dead on the whiteboard. But perhaps I'll open it to you, Sarah, if you think what guess you would put as your best guess theory, that we could give you at this point 4 points if you could.
Thank you for welcoming me to the game.
Yes,
the vet says, as far as he knows, as far as he can tell, they died of heart attacks or heart failure and not
being scared to death.
I can't believe he didn't do a little post-mortem. He didn't even do a little post-mortem.
No, a little post-mortem.
Just a little illegal post-mortem, no. I do like that, because normally it's the person saying to the trying to corrupt the police officer into doing something illegal, and she just floats it, but no, he says no, thank you. So if we are to believe that they were scared to death, that's the question, isn't it? What did that? It made me think when we first saw the corpsicle, which I have to say has now become really banal. Like, it's fantastic.
Yeah, just there.
It's just there.
Yeah, the vet at least was like, "This is weird, bro. You've been staring at this."
I bet that arena smells awful. I just have to say. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, and he has to. Peter Pryor has to kind of remind himself of this horrible thing in front of them. We've become used to it. And even when the nurse says, "Oh, Lund, he doesn't look, you know, he looks awful," and then he was like, "Yeah, this is sort of awful." So it reminded me very much when I first saw the corpsicle of this extraordinary phenomenon which happens. I don't know if you know about the herd of horses who galloped into the water and they froze instantly. It made me think of that. There's some science. But how bizarre it would be if you came along to a lake with frozen horses in
very much
horrified fear. So, and it seems to me too, so there's a couple of things going on. It also seems to me, this is not the case, but someone can die and end up looking as if they were horrified. So there's this whole thing about you can see in their faces that they were horrified. Were they, or is this just the twisting of what happened to them? How did he get them to take off their clothes and fold them neatly? I don't know. Ugh. Okay, so here's my theory. They were running out onto the ice as a fun, spanky sex party, and they had the same thing happen to them as happened to the horses in the lake, where they just instantly froze and their bodies have been contorted for that reason. That's why the clothes are folded and the shoes. Why there are some clothes and shoes missing is that he has come along afterwards and taken some of them. That's my theory.
He being Raymond Clark, or he being mystery person?
He being Raymond Clark. And okay. I will take my 4 points. Thank you.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched the whole show and I can't believe you're so right.
Sex
I
was party, really... I would love. I would love it. A bit of an orgy moment. Love it.
Well, it's not just an orgy, but it's like, we're bored. Let's take our clothes off and run out into the snow. I mean, you must at some point
often
want
say
to do
I'm
that.
Bored. Let me just run out into the snow and take off my clothes. I live in the suburbs, though, so might a lot of pointing, but for different reasons, you know?
That one's crossing. She looks like she's crossing over to the other side. Jess, I have your guess here. It's basically environmental poisoning is what you thought was happening. So
It's so tricky, but I feel like there's too much pointing to the fact that they were not alone when they died. I feel like it's a very apt, like, we're asking the right questions of, like, why would this many grown men be nude out in the cold winter? And, like, you know what I mean? Like, why is there a symbol on the one's forehead? Why did someone like scratch their own eyes out? And I do think there has to be someone else involved in that as a result. I think it could be that Raymond Lund, maybe he has been
Raymond
poisoned.
Lund, you're combining two characters.
Sorry, Raymond Clark. Raymond Clark has been somehow, like, mercury poisoned and takes them hostage, if you will, like forces them to do all of these things.
Yeah.
I don't think this many grown men are like, unless they're having a sex party, like Sarah said, and they're just having some fun romp in the snow. I don't think these men get naked out there and stay out there. I think they're if you're that terrified that you die from fear, there has to be something very scary going on. And I don't know if, like, again, it still could be like mercury poisoning is causing them to hallucinate and run out there. And then they end up dying of being scared of some, maybe a vision, something they're seeing. But I do think, like, at this point, I'm going to narrow it down. I think I will say Raymond Clark forced the men outside and did something that scared them to death. I don't know. I don't know if I have to be more specific because I don't know what he did.
No, that's fine.
But I think he's involved, and I think it's his relationship with Annie and her, obviously her being Inupiaq and all of those connections for him to, something sparks in his brain about the fact that how bad the mining is and on and on and on. And he is now on her side, right? I don't think.
Yeah. So that
we haven't even talked about her video.
We haven't talked about the video.
There's so much.
So
the video is terrifying.
Yeah. The video that she finds the hatch and she says, if I, you know, if someone finds this, and then she screams and she's dead. Very horror movie-ish. I'm so there, Jess. And I wish she didn't say it, cause that's what I would have guessed. But the piece of it that I think, that is the big piece, is like, okay, that's fine if Raymond does it, but what about Raymond and Annie and who and what happened to Annie? So I'm with you, because I do think you have to, I mean, they tell us here's where I'm also, I think it's coming, and I want to, this is another thing I want to make sure I do some research into, which is, I thought for sure Raymond had just killed Annie. And almost in the first episode, I was like, let's like not even guess who killed Annie, because the thing will be like, he did it and somehow it got covered up. I think that that's probably not true now, based on that we see there's these photos of them where they're happy together. One thing I want to acknowledge is that there being photos of them being happy together does not mean he still was abusive and that he might have murdered her. Because right. People who are abused and murdered are often, that has happened to them by the people who claim to love them most, and even people that they love who then do that to women. So that doesn't mean that I'm like taking Raymond off the board, but I think if I want to like live in the show where the show like reveals this information that like they're happy together to some degree, I want to, I think for now, live in the world where like I could definitely see them being like, oh, but actually Raymond was in a cult and he got upset, and when she was opposed to that, whatever. But I do think probably that most likely scenario, he has been basically plotting his revenge on what happened, that it's someone else from the research station was involved in killing Annie. Therefore, Raymond, and I think she's awake, could also be Annie, right?
Annie,
couldn't
yes,
that also be exactly. Annie?
Certainly.
Because certainly, yeah. If it's like, yeah, I've brought her back. Is the circle cult stuff? Is the cult stuff about trying to, for him to see her, right? So I know that this is very similar, but I guess what I'm going to say is that like in terms of, I guess these are very similar, but specifically, I think Raymond gets brought into cult stuff with the symbol because he thinks he can, it's going to get him closer to Annie, right? Is like the piece.
I do think
the idea of like a human sacrifice, that's a very predominant theme in season one. That's where the symbol is. She was seeing it in her brain. We haven't talked about that either, that she was dreaming the symbol. And then when she got the tattoo, it went away. She was investigating them. She finds the hatch. This is like bad stuff. Someone from the mine is like, got to make sure nobody else finds out that we have a secret hatch where there's all the stuff, bad stuff that the mine does on the Sol research station. Essentially, they kill. And he's now like, basically, I'm just going to hang out here until I can get my revenge. And I will sacrifice one of them to basically, in the same way that Rose can see Travis, the way Julia can see her mother, he wants to see Annie. So I know that's basically the same as saying Raymond kills him, but
it just makes me think also that there is, we've all decided, including the characters in the story, that the men died on the ice, undressed, ran out, died on the ice. But there is a version where he, because you think of if there's, you know, five or six of them against one, that's sort of hard to imagine. But it's not out of the question that he killed them somehow with some heart attack inducing drug.
This is one very by helpful. One. Yeah.
One
Let's
by
say
one.
He doesn't kill them the in station, the ice. Yeah. Okay, great.
Undresses them, drags them out, mm-hmm. out, makes the corpsicle. And it is the act of freezing that contorts them into these horrifying horrifying poses.
Interesting.
Because we've had no fascinating. We've had no forensics on it. We've had no forensics. Yeah. The first thing is the vet, the prior vet. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think the difference maybe between our get is that you think he was poisoned, right, Jess? Like you think the environmental or you didn't say that. You didn't say that.
I don't remember if I said that. I think there's something going on with Raymond Clark in terms of mental illness, poisoning, something that sends his mind spinning, if that makes sense.
I think we will find that even if he's a deeply unwell man, he knows pretty much exactly what he's doing because he's trying to do it to get Andy.
Fair.
So that's right.
Yeah,
I'm trying to make our guesses as different as I possibly can.
That's fair. Let's do it. That's the difference.
He knows enough to not be found.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's true. It's true.
Okay. Jess, we're going to get to talk more about the episodes as we keep going. As I said, Dr. Mann and I will be there for the recap, you and I doing a deep dive each week, and then Mike and LaTanya doing verses. But Sarah, I'll give you any final thoughts about episode 3.
Yes, I think thematically what we've discussed is really interesting. And when we go back to the station, because it's really easy to move away from the station and the corpsicle becoming kind of banal and accepted as we go down these other roots and stories and relationships. But if you take it back to the station again, episode 3 also turns our idea of the station because we hear the official story of the station is they all kept to themselves. No one ever saw them. The delivery man comes, that's it. And now we find that people are going and giving them haircuts. People are going and having sex, you know, women are going and having sex with them. So having affairs, however.
Oliver left the station. We heard that they never trade, but he leaves and he goes and lives in an isolated community.
They hold many secrets, that Sol Station.
So it's porous. It's this idea that the official word and the police idea and the white concrete thinking idea of this station is it's a hermetically sealed place, but it seeps in, it seeps out. So I think that's very interesting as well, kind of emblematically here in this story, which I'm absolutely loving. And you know, as soon as you start talking about it, there are 5 other things you didn't say, but
I know it's why that we didn't talk about the thing that this episode ends on. We didn't talk about really about Oliver, you know, there's this
not about this, Hank and like his so involvement rich.
Yeah, Hank about having the
ice fishing. Hank and his hillbillies.
Yeah.
Hank sucks. Yes. In case that needed to be Hank said, it didn't really because we all know he sucks, but he sucks so hard.
And he hit his kid, and then the kids obviously said, "Oh, I fell on the ice." And I loved Amber saying,
"She knows."
Very interesting that an expert ice skater fell on the ice, you know.
Yeah. Jess, final thoughts on the episode?
I loved it. I have my eye on Hank, not in terms of involvement, but certainly like protecting somebody or like the white people of the town, right? It could be as general as that. I'm so excited to see the next episode. I'm loving this season. I think the fact that it is like night country, right? The fact that it is dark all the time, it lends itself to being spooky. I just think everything is working so well together between the casting and the character stories that we're getting and the setting and everything. Even the I forgot to mention this, but the like I don't know what they call it in the subtitles because I remember seeing it, but it was like voice mouth singing. What is it called? They were like making these like
throat singing. It's throat singing.
Thank you. Perfect. Like, I just feel like everything sets the scene so well on this show. So I'm really, really enjoying it.
Yeah. All right. Well, Sarah, thanks so much for joining us this week.
Thank you for asking me.
You're detectiving truly, I have to say.
I am truly detectiving, yes, yeah. Every week on RHAP. I have Crime Scene with Murray Forth, and we will talk about true crime, which is as strange and brutal as the stories that we see here in fictional crime.
I'm sure. I think Issa Lopez has talked about all the stuff that kind of inspired the thing, and people are sending stuff about like, oh, I think it's based on this. It's based on this. Like, there's so much out there. So yeah.
Yes.
Jess, what about you? What else you got going on?
I'm chatting with you on Full Spoiler Recaps. We just covered Griselda, which was really good. You should check it out. It's really, really good. Yeah. And we're covering Scavenger's Reign next week, so that's exciting. And then, of course, over on Shit 90 Shows Taught Me, we are covering Buffy and Felicity. Both are just like everything I wanted. Wow. Just when you need a little bit of like a silly teen drama, it's everything. They're both so good. So check out that. And you can find me at The Jess Sterling.
Aaron and I are taking a week off from Post Show Recaps Theater. There are like no new movies out. So just taking a little break. We'll be back next week, I think, with there's a movie that's coming out this week that is very interesting that I can't remember. So you know, you'll find out later. And
it's a mystery.
Our guy. It's our guy. It actually is a mystery. It's another mystery
thing,
which is our guy, which I learned today is over 2.5 hours. So just keep Ariel and I in your thoughts and prayers for that. But I'm on social media at @HighFromGrace, and we will be back next week with another deep dive and a full week's coverage of True Detective. We'll chat about episode 4. So until next time, bye-bye.